As you notice up on the board, we're going to be talking about the book of Ecclesiastes. And the title of the lesson, Vain Things, is based upon the second verse of Ecclesiastes. Actually, the phrase is used a number of times in that book. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. We're talking about a book that is attributed to Solomon as the writer. You'll notice he calls himself in verse 1 of the text, the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. It is my view that indeed Solomon, who was given wisdom above all men, is the one who wrote the book. There are some who disagree with that due to stylistic differences and such with the book of Proverbs, but we will assume that that is the case. It's not of great concern because it is written ultimately by the Holy Spirit. But it is a book of wisdom, and Solomon certainly was a wise man. Like the book of Proverbs, it seeks to dispense wisdom to men. The difference with regard to the book of Ecclesiastes is that the book is written, majority of it at least, discussing the value of earthly possessions and accomplishments without reference to God. And so when we look at that phrase in verse 2 of the text, vanity of vanities, all is vanity, I don't know that any of us would agree with that assessment, that everything that is on the earth is vain. But if you look at it the way the wise man looks at it, I think you can consider and understand what he means. So just look at two verses to illustrate this particular point, and we will ask you to follow along in the book of Ecclesiastes as we'll be ranging throughout the book in our lesson this morning. I want you to notice, first of all, chapter 1 and verse 3, where the wise man asks the question, what profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? I want you to notice that phrase, under the sun. Notice also in verse 13 of the text, when the wise man set his heart to seek and search out wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven, this burdensome task God has given to the sons of men by which they may be exercised. There are two phrases there, under the sun and under heaven, that seem to indicate that what he's talking about are the things that we have here in life, or that we do here in life. And really at this point in time, God who is in heaven, God who is above the earth, is not under consideration. So we ask ourselves, do you have any or place any value upon anything that exists in your earthly life? Do you place value upon your job, upon your interests, your hobbies, your education, your health? Do you place value upon some of the things that you possess in your home or on your person? I imagine that you do. We all have certain things that are valuable to us, that have value. But the question we want to ask is that value relative or is it intrinsic? Is there really any intrinsic value in these things if they are separated from a spiritual life, a successful spiritual life that you live? In other words, ultimately, are they going to be any value in eternity? That's the question that we're asking. You know what Jesus had to say on this matter in Matthew chapter 16 when he asked the question in verse 26, what does it profit if a man gains the whole world and loses his own soul? What shall a man give in exchange for his soul? So ultimately, if you sacrifice your standing with God in the pursuit of your job or your possessions or education or anything like that, then ultimately the value is not there. The life that you live is a life of vanity, and all is vain without God in the picture. I've preached a lesson just a number of months ago on the subject of parenthood and the responsibility of the father, and that he is not to abdicate his responsibility to the wife. He is to be the spiritual leader in the home. And I indicated that the only way that a man can be successful as a husband and as a father is if he is a faithful Christian. And there are many individuals who would disagree with that. Well, my husband, he's not a Christian, but he's a good father. But he's a good husband. He's a good wage earner. He cares for us and he loves us. And that may very well be true. In fact, I would not dispute that. But when God describes what a successful father is, And that successful father is one who brings his children up in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. Someone who's not doing that is not successful, because ultimately God defines what is a successful father, what is a successful husband, what is a successful man, what is a successful woman, what is a successful individual. God makes those determinations. And so, while there may be value in being a good breadwinner, while there may be value in showing affection to your children, of being a disciplinarian and teaching your child to be a good citizen or obedient to authority, fact is, if we're not being obedient to the authority which is from above, then ultimately there is no intrinsic or lasting value. Let's just give you a couple of illustrations, considering the concept of value as it applies to earthly things. Webster gives as one of the definitions for value something that is relative worth or utility or importance. Let me give you just an example of that. My wife Debbie and I, neither of us graduated from college, but we both went to college for several years, and her degree was fine arts. She wanted to be a fine arts major, and so she had a number of art classes while she was going to college, and it was extremely important to her. She was an individual who valued a fine art degree, was interested in that discipline. Do you realize, if you go on Google and you do a search with regard to the least helpful degree, the most worthless degree, in other words, with regard to getting employment prospects and to make a living, they'll tell you it's fine arts. I'm sorry, Debbie, but that's just the way it is. And so while it is that she ascribes, she has a relative view of its value that differs from the world. In general, the world says that, well, fine arts may be fine, but that it really is not going to help you get a job or make a living. We could even say something similar with regard to a possession like gold, for example. Gold is a dense, soft, yellow metal, and it has value because it's pretty and because it's fairly rare. There are things that are much more rare than gold, but it is relatively rare. But it's an interesting thing that if you go back in time, into the 19th century, when Napoleon was the ruler of France, that Napoleon did not have platters of gold with which to impress his noblemen and those he held feast for. Instead, he had platters and silverware that was made out of aluminum. Aluminum. And the reason for that, in Napoleon's time, aluminum was more rare than gold because at that point in time, they did not have the ability to refine it as easily. And as a result of that, it was more value. It had greater value. So Napoleon served his guests on aluminum platters as a means of basically showing off. Now, if we take it, utilizing those ideas, ultimately gold's just a hunk of metal. And when you're talking about gold jewelry, the only reason that gold jewelry has any value is because individuals are willing to pay for it. The value is not intrinsic. And when you look at what the Scripture has to say specifically about gold, I remind you of what was said by the Apostle Peter in 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 6, when he said, "You greatly rejoice in this time for a little while, if need be, though you have been grieved by various trials, that the genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ, whom having not seen, you love." And so what is much more precious than this metal, this hunk of yellow metal that is deemed extremely valuable by the world? Your faith. And in comparison, there is no great or lasting or intrinsic value in gold at all. So when we talk about earthly things, value can only be determined relatively. Without God in the picture, earthly possessions and accomplishments have no lasting worth. And that's why the preacher said, "Vanity of vanities, all is vanity." So what I want to do is just spend a few moments looking at some things without intrinsic or lasting value that men seek and desire to the detriment of their souls. We're going to begin by noting earthly wisdom. There's a reference to this in the book of Ecclesiastes, and I would like you to note what is said there. Ecclesiastes chapter 1 and verse 13 to start off with. The wise man said on that occasion, chapter 1 and verse 13, "I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. This burdensome task God has given to the sons of men by which they may be exercised. And I have seen all the works that are done under the sun. Indeed, all is vanity and grasping for the wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight. What is lacking cannot be numbered. It's kind of interesting. Kind of interesting quote there, especially that last verse, verse 15, what's intended by it. The king in our text, the wise man Solomon, he sought to know, in effect, how the world works. And he was an urbane man. He was a man who was educated. He was a man of experience. He was a man who was a ruler over the nation of Israel. But what he saw ultimately is that this knowledge doesn't really accomplish a great deal. I read that passage and I started to think about our national issues that we find today. And we find that every single cycle of elections, you have individuals who will put forth a platform. And they will purport to have the answers to what is wrong with our nation. And so what they will do is they will put forth their particular evidence, their particular views, their particular programs that they want to espouse. And especially at the presidential level, the idea is if you elect me, things will get better. All of the problems, or most of the problems, or many of the problems will be solved. We can do this if we do it together. You know, that promise has been made from the time the nation was born until today. And you have presidents who will say, look at how much better I made it. And the very next president, he'll come up and he'll say, look how bad it was. I'm going to change things. And now we're going to make it better now. And they just basically undo all of the things that the president before them did and go in a completely different direction because their view differs from what his view was. I mean, when you have Joe Biden, for example, as our president, who has this idea that he's going to pass this bill to build back better. The idea is if you spend this money, if we start these programs, then that's going to solve problems. Well, the wise man here said in verse 15, what is crooked can't be made straight. And what is lacking cannot be numbered. And throughout the history of our nation, throughout the history of the world, the poor remain, lawlessness remains, unfairness continues. We could go on and on with the ills of society, and we know that this world is imperfect. And in fact, even knowing how the world works doesn't affect lasting change. It doesn't solve problems. We have basically unsolvable problems. I don't mean to be just completely depressing with regard to our statement, but brethren, if you're looking for a utopia to arise out of our nation or any other nation because of what men propose with their human wisdom, it's just not going to happen. That's not the way the world has ever worked since sin entered into it. And that's something we need to just recognize. So when we talk about wisdom, I want you to consider a couple of things. Notice, first of all, Luke chapter 16, the parable of the unjust steward. I want you to notice what was said about the unjust steward. He acted in a very unscrupulous way in trying to make as much money as he could in his dealings and his backdoor dealings. And yet, the master commended him. Notice verse 8, Luke 16. The master commended the unjust steward because he had dealt shrewdly. He says here, the sons of this world are more shrewd in their generation than the sons of light. And an interesting statement that Jesus says as application of this particular parable. Of course, the steward acted in a selfish and unrighteous manner, but he knew how the world worked. And there is a lesson here. What is the lesson? Well, it is stated in verse 9 of that text. We want to, if we can, consider how the world works, but for what purpose? Notice verse 9. I say to you, make friends for yourselves by unrighteous mammon, that when you fail, they may receive you into an everlasting home. This individual is working selfishly. He was being shrewd. He tells us as Christians to act shrewdly as well, not unjustly, not unrighteously, but to deal shrewdly so that we can use those things that we gain from that in order to do work for the kingdom, in order to gain acceptance from the master in eternity, so that we might be received into an everlasting home. And so the use of unrighteous mammon, or money, In fact, do it in such a way as to bring your acceptance of God, generosity, benevolence, hospitality, those kinds of things. In verse 38 of that same book in Luke chapter 6 in verse 38, you'll remember that statement, give, it will be given to you, good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over, will be put into your bosom, for with the same measure that you use, it will be measured back to you. The thing about this, though, is it's that shrewdness, that understanding the way the world works, but based on a divine wisdom rather than an earthly wisdom. The earthly wisdom was selfish. The unscrupulous a servant here, he used his knowledge of the way the world worked in order to gain for himself, to be selfish. Where Jesus says, if you're going to be aware of how things work, utilize those to be selfless, to prepare for yourself a place in heaven. And so when we talk about earthly wisdom, understand that earthly wisdom is ultimately vain. Notice in the same text, chapter 1 of Ecclesiastes in verse 16, the wise man communed with his heart, saying, look, I have attained greatness, gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge. I set my heart to know wisdom, to know madness and folly. And I perceive this also as grasping for the wind. That is, it's vain. For in much wisdom is grief. And he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. If what we're talking about is gaining wisdom, and that wisdom comes from men, or that wisdom comes from the purpose or desire to accomplish things as a man without reference to God, then ultimately it's foolishness. When you get that kind of wisdom, about all that you've done is you know more than other people know, but that increases the care on your heart. Yeah, children are ignorant often, and they're happy because they're ignorant. They don't know about all the dangers in life. They don't know about the evil in life. They don't know about how people treat one another. And as they have their mom and their dad and a little bit of food in their belly and a place to sleep, then they're just as happy as they possibly can be. They don't know the evil of the world. They're not wise. They're naive. They're ignorant. And yet they're happy. And all that the wisdom of the world brings is grief if it is not utilized for the purpose of serving God. In fact, in James chapter 3, there is an example that we're given in James 3 as a description is given of the wisdom which is from below. He said, if you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, don't boast and lie against the truth. This wisdom doesn't descend from above, but is earthly, sensual, and demonic, or of demons, of the devil. And that kind of wisdom, yeah, people know the way the world works and people understand and figure out and have discernment as to how to accomplish their purposes. But because this wisdom does not come from above, it is selfish in its intent. The desire is to bring division and to accomplish what is best for you and you alone. But you'll notice, we're told in verse 16, where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and everything are there. In verse 17, the wisdom that is from above is pure, peaceable, and gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality, without hypocrisy. The fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. We want the wisdom that comes from God, because that's the only one that has lasting value, that which comes from God himself. Let's get to a second point in this regard. There's three basic principles that really cover the gamut of the experience of man. I want you to notice in chapter 2 and verse 1, the next thing that the wise man tried. He said, I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with mirth. Therefore, enjoy pleasure. But surely this also is vanity. I said of laughter, it's madness. Of mirth, what does it accomplish? I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine, while guiding my heart with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven all the days of their lives. The wise man pursued pleasure. There are some people who advocate that this kind of experiential knowledge is the only knowledge that has really any value. I remember having a Bible discussion with another individual. He was pretty ignorant, but he was very prideful in his views. And we were discussing the Bible, and we were looking at what the Scripture says. And he told me, he said, Stan, when you gain a little bit more experience, you're going to see things my way. If you just go out in the world and see how things really are, then you're going to change your point of view. The idea that you got to experience these things in order to really know what's going on. You know, I really don't have to do that. I don't have to do what the wise man did and explore mirth and pleasure and not withhold anything from myself with regard to the material pleasures of life, because he already did and he already told me that it's vain. So why would I have to do the very same thing that he did? I can learn from his example. And it's important because it is something that is universally true. But Americans typically have the same attitude that Solomon did, as expressed in our text. And as a result of that, they have imbibed and do imbibe in those things of the flesh to gain enjoyment and pleasure, not realizing that the same lesson will come to them as it did to the wise man, that it's ultimately vain. There's a text in Ephesians chapter 5 that's talking about singing songs, hymns, and spiritual songs and praise to God and the joy that comes from that. But it is a contrast. In verse 18 of Ephesians 5, it says, "Do not be drunk with wine, in which is dissipation, but instead be filled with the Spirit, speaking to one another, psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs." Where does the joy come? It doesn't come in getting drunk. That's dissipation. That's ruin that comes as a result of that. How many people have said, you know, I'm going to try out that drinking. I'm going to see how it feels to drink alcohol. And they drink, they get drunk, perhaps they become alcoholics, they lose their family, they lose their job, they lose their health as a result of it. It leads to ruin. Because ultimately a hedonistic life, a life that is spent in pursuit of pleasure, leads to dissolution. But in contrast, we note that worship to God is something that is beneficial and uplifting. Notice 1 Peter chapter 4. 1 Peter chapter 4 in verse 1 of the text. "The one who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, that he should no longer live the rest of his time in the flesh for the lust of men, but for the will of God." This is the lesson that we need to learn. When we become children of God, we no longer live for our own selfish desires to seek the joy and the pleasure that we can receive from earth. Instead, we live for the will of God. We have spent enough of our past lifetime in doing the will of the Gentiles. That's basically what the wise man said. I tried it all, and I saw that it led to dissolution. It led ultimately to vanity, and then I learned a lesson. The lesson that we'll talk about at the end of our time. Fear God, keep His commandments, for this is man's all. That's what he learned. And that's what Peter is saying that we should learn as well. We spent enough of our past lifetimes doing what the Gentiles do. We walked in lewdness, lust, drunkenness, revelries, drinking parties, and abominable idolatries. But we did that enough. Now we are to cease from sin, living not only for our own will, but for the will of God. Notice, in regard to these Gentiles, they think it's strange you don't run with them in that same flood of dissipation. And they speak evil of you. They will give an account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. They'll give an account. Why? Because God opposes such action. A life lived for enjoyment, just for pleasure without respect to God, the vanity of that life is something that becomes evident. God will judge those who engage in that. Psalm 11 and verse 4. You remember that beautiful passage. The Lord is in His holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. His eyes behold, His eyelids test the sons of men. The Lord tests the righteous, but the wicked and the one who loves violence, His soul hates. Those who seek such hedonistic pleasure are opposed by God. There is no value. Those things are indeed vain. And then finally, we talk about earthly possessions. Not only is our society characterized by hedonism, the pursuit of pleasure, but it's also characterized by materialism. Jesus warned, "Take heed and beware of covetousness, for one's life does not consist of the abundance of the things that he possesses." And this is something that the wise man finally understood and recognized as well. You'll notice in the text of chapter 2 of Ecclesiastes, beginning in verse 4, he said, "I made my works great. I built myself houses and planted myself vineyards and made myself gardens and orchards and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. I acquired male and female servants had servants born in my house. I had greater possessions of herds and flocks than all who were in Jerusalem before me. And I also gathered for myself silver and gold, and the special treasures of kings and of the provinces. I acquired male and female singers, and the delights of the son of men, and musical instruments of all kinds. I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem, and my wisdom remained with me. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I didn't withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my reward from my labor. And then I looked on all the works that my hands had done, and on the labor in which I had toiled, and indeed, all was vanity, and grasping for the wind, there was no profit under the sun. You know, when you look at that, typically what you would find is, look at me, look what I've accomplished, here is the litany, here is the list of all the good things that I have done, what I've accomplished, what I've gained, isn't it wonderful? But that's not what the wise man said. I looked at it all and I said, this is vanity. It's grasping for the wind. There's just nothing intrinsically valuable, nothing that lasts. And indeed, possessions bring no lasting satisfaction. You remember the rich fool in Luke chapter 12 and verse 18? He had gained so much that he said, you know, I'm going to tear down my barns, and I'm going to build greater, and I'll store all my crops and my goods. I'll say to my soul, so you have many goods laid up for many years. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry. But God said to him, fool, this night your soul will be required of you. Then whose will those things be which you have provided? Any individual who is foolish, or is foolish who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. Notice chapter 5 of Ecclesiastes, chapter 5 and verse 10. Chapter 5 and verse 10. He who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver, nor he who loves abundance with increase. This is vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. So what profit have their owners except to see them with their eyes? The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep. Isn't that amazing? And it is so anecdotally true. You can see it again and again. Who is it that sleeps best? The simple man who works hard for his money. He has a simple life. He has enough, but not a lot more. But the rich man is so worried. He's so worried about who may steal it. He's so worried about increasing it. He's so worried about maintaining it. He's so worried of what the government might do, those who might try to take it away from him, that he might not be able to control what he has, that he may not in the future have what he has in the present, and he worries about it and he can't sleep. We can think about that. We recognize that that's the case. You're not, if you have your interest in possessions, possessions bring no lasting satisfaction. Care for the things that you possess bring unrest and concern, and that's why rich people are the ones that need the safes and the locks. So you've got, any of you guys have a wall safe behind a fancy painting? Because a lot of rich people do. But they got to hide what it is that they have so nobody will take what they have, and they worry about those things. Ultimately, there's no great value to be placed in them. And so what approach should we have to possessions? I want to leave you in this point with one final passage from 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verses 6 through 8, where he says, Paul to Timothy, godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain that we will carry nothing out. And having food and clothing with these, we will be content. That's the proper attitude. Because the child of God should, if he does not, he should realize that there is no lasting intrinsic value in the possessions that this world holds for us. As we draw our lesson to a close, I want you to go toward the latter part of the book of Ecclesiastes. There's a couple of verses that I want to read to you that begins to show the proper attitude that we ought to have toward worldly things. possessions, wisdom, the pursuit of joy and mirth. Christians' approach should be different. Notice in chapter 9 and verse 3. This is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that one thing happens to all. Truly the hearts of the Son of Man are full of evil. Madness is in their heart while they live, and after that, they go to the dead. Does that not describe our world, the world in which we live today? When you look at the world, there is madness in the world because there is evil in the world. There are leaders who desire to do evil. There are anarchists who are unwilling to accept the law of the land. There are individuals who are selfish in their actions, striving only to exalt and help themselves and not concerned with others. And it doesn't matter if they're successful in oppressing others or not. And it doesn't matter whether you are a righteous individual or one of them. The fact remains that you live and that you die. And there cannot be ultimate fulfillment in this world because there is evil that is here. Notice chapter 10, and the same thing is true. It is stated in chapter 10 in verses 8 and 9 that he who digs a pit will fall into it. Whoever breaks through a wall will be bitten by a serpent. He who quarries stones may be hurt by them, and he who splits wood may be endangered by it. Isn't that true? Even when you're trying to do good things, you're trying to help yourself, you're trying to accomplish something that is of worth ultimately, it can be that you're harmed by those efforts that you make. That's just kind of the way the world works. How many times have you been building something and slammed your thumb with the hammer? I remember that Debbie and I, and I probably used this illustration before, but for a while we were trying to make little trinkets to sell at Christmas, woodworking, and I had a bandsaw that I used. And one of the things we had during the Christmas area were a bunch of reindeer. I hated those reindeer because you had to cut each one out. They were small, and there were legs for each one. And so I was cutting out tens, maybe hundreds of legs all at one time and getting tired of it. And I'm doing it. And I'm thinking to myself, Debbie wants me to do it. She wants me to do it. And this is going to help. We're going to make a little money doing this. And then I flicked my finger right through this bend, the saw on the bandsaw. Just took off the tip of my finger. And you still see the scar. I mean, I flick it with my left finger like that. And I still got the scar to show it. And I hurt myself. I was trying to do something that would benefit me, something to be good for both stuff, but I hurt myself in that regard. And that's just kind of the way the world works. Those plans to invest, and the investment goes upside down, and you lose your money, you lose your shirt. The plans to buy a car, and then you wreck the car. The plans to dig the pit, and then you fall in. Those things happen. It's the way the world is. Ultimately, because of chance, happenstance, because of the unfairness of this world, because of the evil men, you can't ultimately find fulfillment here on this earth. It doesn't work that way. And so individuals who are trying to do it, which basically make up the majority of the world today, I want fulfillment from this earth. I want to get something out of it. I want a sense of worth. I want to accomplish something while I'm here on this earth. I'm going to put my emphasis on those things, that it's ultimately doomed to failure. That's why the world is full of nihilists, because they're humanist ultimately, and they think this is what the world is about. Life lived under the sun, life lived under heaven. You're going to be remembered by the things that you accomplish. I can change the world. And then if they get to the end of their lives, they realize the world's going to go on and forget them. And what they've done ultimately has no great lasting intrinsic value. And so what are we to do? Well, rather than becoming depressed by it, understand instead how you're supposed to look at it. How the wise man eventually came to look at it. So he tried all of these things. And then we're told in verse 13, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God, keep His commandments, for this is man's all. That's what it's all about, to fear God and keep His commandments. Now, I want you to notice verse 14 ties in with verse 13, but why? He first describes that this is man's all. This is the whole of man. This is the whole, if you look at the King James Version, the whole duty of man. This is why we're here. Why am I on earth? What is this all about? Tell you what it is. It's to fear God and to keep His commandments. Why is that? Because God's going to judge you. That's ultimately why the only thing that has lasting value is to be accepted by Him. Because we're not here for the 80 years or so that we live upon this earth. We are here to prepare ourselves for the eternity in which we will either be in the presence of God or we will not. And the litmus test to determine whether or not we will be with God or not is accomplished while we're living here. If we fear God and keep His commandments, when God comes in judgment, notice verse 14, God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil. When that judgment day is coming, it is coming, and when it comes, if we are found faithful to Him, then He'll say to us, well done, thou good and faithful servant, enter ye into my rest. That means that the life that we lived had value. Lasting value. Intrinsic value. Because what we accomplished by doing what we did gives us an eternity in the presence of God. But if He says to us, depart from me, you workers of iniquity, then that means no matter what we did on earth, no matter how much money we made, no matter how many possessions we gained, no matter which wisdom we gained, or prestige or honor, ultimately it has no lasting value. Ultimately it is vain, because we will be in that place where the worm does not die, the fire is not quenched, where there is weeping and gnashing of teeth forever and ever. Lasting value comes with the soul. What does a man profit if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? What will a man give in exchange for his soul? Ultimate true value is only found in service to the Lord. I hope the lesson has helped you have that proper perspective with regard to what God requires of us and our obedience to Him. We're going to offer an invitation at this time, not knowing the hearts of any. We appreciate very much your kind attention and consideration of these words. If you're not a child of God, we call upon you to become obedient, that you might serve Him acceptably, to spend an eternity in His presence, that your life might have value. If you have, as a child of God, in some way kind of messed up and forgotten what's important and lost your way by imbibing in those worldly things that have no lasting value, then we call upon you to repent and turn back to God. If we can assist you in any way to answer that invitation call, we offer ourselves to you at this time. We ask that you come. All together we stand while we sing.